suggested or have been planned for the Northwest due to the large increase in fossil fuels extraction in parts of Canada and the United States. And so there's lots and lots of supply moving through the country, much of it going to other cities in the U.S., but much of it with the hope to selling it to Asia. Second, these storage facilities and trains have raised significant concerns by all of you and by the public about noise, about traffic, safety, potentially air, water, land, pollution impacts, especially as these move, the trains move through Portland and through tribal lands and communities and through environmentally sensitive areas in the Columbia Gorge. And finally, you adopted the resolution because it's connected to our goals related to climate change. As you know, we're an international leader, really, on reducing carbon emissions locally. And we have a goal to significantly reduce our fossil fuel reliance. So those are some of the reasons that you adopted the resolution. At the same time, you recognized when you adopted the resolution that Portland does serve as a hub for transportation fuels for Oregon and for Portland and for all of, actually parts of Southwest Washington also. And this is important as an economic issue, not just for Portland, but for the whole region. So you directed us to definitely take that into consideration as we develop the ordinance. So we listened to that direction, developed a draft ordinance, and today we'd like to walk through some of the background on that. Michael will start with a review of what's actually in the November resolution and provide you with some background on fossil fuel demand related to that sort of hub issue in terms of us being a place that stores and facilitates the movement of oil and natural gas. And then Tom will review the specifics of the proposed zoning code amendment, identifying, like we have at these work sessions, some of the issues that we think that you're going to hear about, that we've heard about through the stakeholder engagement that we've done over the past 8-9 months. So I think I'll hand it over to the Armstrong, not brothers, but Michael will start with sort of some of the background, and Tom will then walk through the ordinance. I think this is a really good example of one of the things where when we put planning and sustainability together, that it's been a great overlap and been really easy to get this issue dealt with a lot more smoothly. Thanks.
All right, thanks, Susan. Mayor and Commissioners, I'm Michael Armstrong with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. So as Susan noted, the resolution that was adopted last November, you know, established a position to oppose fossil fuel infrastructure, but at the same time was specific that the intent was not to restrict, you know, improvements to safety, efficiency, seismic resilience, or the operations of existing facilities. It also specified that it was not intended to restrict service that's provided directly to end users, and a couple of other kind of specific circumstances, power fuels supplying backup generators to generate electric power, or infrastructure that would help accelerate the transition to non-fossil fuel energy sources, such as those that are helping meet the state's low carbon fuel standard. So oppose, but do not restrict. And that's what we've been trying to solve for with this zoning code amendment. The comprehensive plan also included the policy that you see noted there on the bottom of this slide. Susan alluded to the kind of many different factors that we're trying to address here: public safety, environmental risks, climate change. This is a map that shows the susceptibility to liquefaction through the Portland area. The existing tanks are overwhelmingly located in a liquefiable soil zone along the in Northwest Portland along the river. That is a concern. The rail routes that transport currently oil through Portland run through Northeast and North Portland neighborhoods. Livability impacts there, traffic issues as well. And then we also have the larger questions around climate change. And so on the next slide, you've got both city's goal, jointly shared with Multnomah County, which is to reduce carbon emissions in and from actions in Multnomah County by 80% by 2050. We're making good progress. We're now at 21% below 1990 levels, even with all the population growth, strong economy. Our goal is similar, very slightly more aggressive than the state's goal, which is also to reduce emissions 75% below 1990 levels by 2050. And so at a broader perspective, how we handle fossil fuel infrastructure factors into implementation of state and local climate plans. We're mindful that Portland, as Susan noted, serves as an important hub to the rest of the state, a little bit into Idaho, Southwest Washington as well. So at least 90% of petroleum that is delivered throughout Oregon passes through the Portland terminals, all kinds of infrastructure to support that. Similarly, Northwest Natural, for its natural gas distribution system, has a storage facility in Portland. They do have LNG there. It's an important part of making sure that they can serve their end users on those cold winter days. And so one of the issues that we have looked at, and I think you'll hear about from interested parties, is, well, is demand going up or not? Because if we're trying to accommodate service for end users, we want to get a handle on what that demand is. And so you'll hear people both talk about sort of the long view, going back decades, where, yes, over the last 50 years, we have increased consumption of fossil fuels in Oregon, this first slide for transportation, but really that has leveled off. And so if you take the more recent trends over the past 10, 15 years, usage has been flat or falling, and certainly that's something our transportation department is extremely familiar with in terms of our revenues. It's a very real thing. People disagree about whether that trend will continue to trend downwards or whether we are at a plateau that will kind of resume its former growth. I think there's a lot of evidence from federal fuel efficiency standards right along to electric vehicles that we are not likely to see renewed growth in fossil fuel use for transportation in Oregon, but people disagree about that. So you'll certainly get people weighing in on that question.
So then the trend for last year was actually up. I'm not last year, 2014. Why don't we have 2015 data?
We will add that in. I believe that those numbers are now available.
Because it would be interesting to look at also gas prices in relation to this as well as the other things.
Right. These are part of a federal series, and so for consistency going back, we stuck with the whole series, but I'll see if we can add in 2015. So very quickly now, the natural gas picture is generally similar. From the long view, usage has gone up more recently, and for Northwest Natural, they are still gaining customers, but usage per customer is going down. And so they believe they're going to need a little more gas, probably not a lot, but a little. You see that reflected in the trends here. Natural gas usage is very weather-dependent, so cold winter. And Northwest Natural, they must solve for peak day. And so their ability to moderate that as they get more customers, they could see higher peaks. And so they're very sensitive to those questions. Total usage, pretty flat, even as they add customers. So, and to wrap up with the usage trends, this is why you will hear different opinions about this. And even just looking back over the last 15 years, the Federal Energy Information Administration puts out an annual energy forecast, annual energy outlook that includes a whole variety of forecasts. This chart shows in 2003 what they were forecasting demand to be going forward, which is the top line. And then the much lower line is their forecast as of 2015. And so, you know, past performance not necessarily indicative of future. People disagree about this. The best minds who work on this have been really wrong about past trends. There are a lot of things pushing toward flattening consumption, but people will disagree about this. So we can come back to this maybe in questions, but I want to get on into...
Just one other thing to add is that when you look at what our goals are around the Climate Action Plan, those are absolutely to reduce the use of fossil fuels. And so if we are successful, then in Portland, absolutely, this trend is going down. So these numbers here were for
statewide.
The state. We know the numbers in Portland are going down. We obviously, because we're the hub, have to care about the entire state. But as we move forward, we also know that other cities, other counties are looking at the climate action planning kind of process as for economic development, for environmental reasons, for a lot of other reasons, that they too will be taking actions along with their utilities, along with their transportation departments, to reduce demand. And so we just don't see from both a behavior change point of view that demand is going down, and also from a shifting of the supply, in other words, that we are shifting away from gasoline to electricity, and that's only going to increase.
Okay, Tom Armstrong with BPS, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what the proposed zoning code amendments are. Right now, these fossil fuel terminals are basically considered a warehouse and distribution use. They bring the fuels in, they store it, and then it goes out by some other mode, means, truck, pipeline, barge. So what we're doing to focus on the fossil fuel terminals is creating a new land use called bulk fossil fuel terminal, and then we're saying it's prohibited. It's prohibited in all of our zones, not just our industrial zones. And where that prohibition really applies to new facilities, but it also affects the existing facilities and what they can do. And so if it's an outright prohibition, the existing terminals become legal non-conforming uses, but that comes with its own set of issues, and we'll talk about that in just a bit of what some of the options are. So we define bulk fossil fuel terminals as having some access that sort of represents the regional gateway facility, so a marine dock, a rail line, a pipeline. Again, the Portland Harbor is the end of the pipeline, the Olympic pipeline coming from the Puget Sound refineries. So you have to have a site that has at least one of those three sort of transportation access points, and then either what we call a transloading facility, something that would be shifting it from, say, a rail car to a barge, or some large storage capacity. And we have set, and at least in the initial proposal, a 5 million gallon threshold of that, having at least 5 million gallons, and that is, we arrived at that number as being it's basically one very large tank. It's a little bit below all of the existing terminals that are out there today, but it does provide some margin to operate underneath that for smaller facilities. Things like a biofuel facility that has a mix of both, petroleum diesel and new ethanol and other clean fuels and that sort of thing. We, based on the resolution, we also include a number of specific exclusions not to capture those, wrap up some people, especially around end user facilities. We had, as part of our public outreach process, we had a lot of concern, especially by the port and the airport aviation fuel facility, and making that clear that that is an end user facility. Also from manufacturers that use fossil fuels as an input, and so they might have a large storage tank on their site that they use to make something. But the one thing that we get into with that is, what is the definition of a fossil fuel? And we have identified, petroleum products and gas fuels, and specifically calling out made from decayed plants and animals that lived millions of years ago. And that's really to distinguish it from biogas, because we're seeing food composting digesters and capture methods from landfills and from the sewage treatment plant, and we wanted to distinguish that source material. I think one of the things that we heard public comment on through the process was around methanol, and is methanol a product, because you take natural gas and water and go through a process to create methanol. So it has a big fossil fuel input to it. The output can be used for a variety of things, similar to what we got in the debate over Pembina, is the propane being used as an input to making plastics and other materials, or is it being used as a fuel? In the end, we've recommended in the proposal before the PSC is to include methanol, specifically as a fuel type, that's part of this definition. And we've tried to sort of, again, include some exclusions to make clear that biodiesel and some other renewable fuel products are not, don't get wrapped up in this definition. Again, as I touched on earlier, we have 11 terminals out there that fit within this definition that have more than basically more than 5 million gallons of storage out there. And so one of the key issues is what is their status and what can they do with their changing their operations as it reacts to both the market and new clean fuel standards. And how is that going forward? I think one of the questions that Michael started to allude to has to do around what is the economic impact. These terminals actually have a pretty low employment density with only about 280 direct jobs out there today. The jobs forecast is somewhere around 1% per year over the next 25 years out to 2035. So not a huge part of our industrial job growth, but they are middle wage jobs. The other factors that come into this, as Michael implied, that as a regional fossil fuel distribution hub, how much of an economic impact will there be around, is it going to restrict the supply of fossil fuels to the statewide economy, or through these other measures in terms of efficiencies and other policy direction, is that demand for fuel going to decrease anyway? And then the other emerging issue in all of this has to do with safety, and what is the risk from a catastrophic event, an accident or an earthquake, in both in terms of the seismic safety of these facilities and being able to get our economy and lifestyle back online, and also just the hazardous content of the fuel itself and what damage it might do if there is a catastrophic release of this material, both either in terms of an explosion or fire or leaking into the river that we're now trying to clean up through the Superfund site.
Just maybe it's a good time to just pose two questions. What are the kinds of things that a legal non-conforming use can and can't do, and how does this change the regulatory framework going forward?
Sure, that's on the next slide there.
Next slide.
And,
all right, so we'll hold that one for a second.
Right.
And then your economic analysis, I think, does a good job of describing the situation on the harbor, but the resolution also called for assessing what are the impacts. So how do you measure the impacts of any of these changes?
We haven't done a lot of detailed measurement of the impacts. I think as Michael set up in sort of looking at the consumption trends, there's a lot of uncertainty about going forward. Is the flat demand or flat consumption trend going to continue, especially in face of, even though we've been growing our economy over this period, the consumption trends are flat. At the same time, we have new initiatives to continue to drive down that demand curve. And so would a restriction on the storage capacity of fossil fuels, is there even going to be demand for that added storage capacity? So there's lots of moving parts to this, but in bringing these issues forward, we just have not had, I guess, a lot of time to really dig deeply into, if you push this lever, where does it go, and what are the many different ways that it could play out in the economy? So far, we went through our typical process of holding some stakeholder group meetings on different code concepts, and we had a discussion draft out for public comment. We now have a proposed draft in front of the Planning and Sustainability Commission, who held a hearing on this last week. And emerging out of those comments are a couple of key issues. One is where or should we stick with or lower, I guess, the 5 million gallon threshold? Should we look at essentially prohibiting new facilities with some lower lower threshold? One unit train has been offered up as a standard, which is about 2 million gallons, or even going to zero and saying we just don't want any more of these types of facilities in Portland, especially given the seismic risk of our industrial areas.
I think one thing there that's important is, as you'll hear during the hearing, is there's a strong desire to do two things at the same time. And one is to have the tanks that are there actually make seismic improvements, which basically almost always means getting rid of that tank and putting in a new tank. To do that, without a regulation saying you have to do that, means that there sort of needs some sweetener almost. In other words, the company may need to make the tank 5 million gallons bigger or something in order to feel like that they are being able to make more money on this investment because they're making this larger investment in a new tank. And so the 5 million gallons to some extent is a way to provide an incentive to do the seismic improvements. The flip side of that is if there's not demand anyway, which I truly believe for the next 20 years that's going to make them need this increase, then would they make that investment anyway?
Well, they haven't been making those investments except at a glacial pace over the past decades. When there haven't been restrictions. So it seems to me at this point that if we're going to get significant seismic strengthening, it's going to be through changes in building codes, not through anything that we do in this process.
Right, and I think related to that issue is the issue that Commissioner Fish brought up, which is, for the existing terminal, should they be considered a non-conforming use or a conditional use? Whether you're doing an expansion or a limited expansion or even replacing a tank for seismic purposes, do they need to go through a land use review process, which comes with its own uncertainty in terms of timeline and appeals, or should we provide a clear path for them to do those seismic upgrades and in combination with a building code sort of change to accelerate that pace? One of the key issues is for that replacement tank, should they go through a land use review? Should we offer some simpler path with either just one for one replacement or a minor expansion to provide an incentive for doing that? I think the other thing that we heard is from Northwest Natural about their LNG facility on the river and their sort of obligation from the PUC to provide a service and how that being a regulated utility might be a different status in terms of being providing more direct service to end users as opposed to being purely just a distribution company kind of thing. So those are issues that we are working through. Obviously, the seismic upgrades a big issue, and we've been talking to PBEM and BDS about sort of learning from their unreinforced masonry building program that they're bringing forward and trying to have sort of as a separate initiative at follow-on action to do a similar process for these larger tanks. To begin to increase that pace of upgrades.
Do you think we could take just a minute and have you give us a quick primer on strengths and weaknesses of both approaches, non-conforming versus conditional use?
Yeah,
or
so
just sort of factors to consider as we.
So with the non-conforming use, it's a pretty hard line in terms of and a pretty clear message that you don't belong. You don't belong in our industrial areas or our employment areas, and that we expect those to be phased out over time. And so consequently, we would need to write some special rules and standards about how you do seismic upgrades and one-for-one replacements, but it would be a pretty strict limit. The conditional use is more of a message of, you're okay here, but we're going to put some tight limits on what you can do and what kinds of impacts you can have. And again, we can write a similar set of standards that says, well, maybe you're allowed to expand by 10%, but you have to go through a conditional use process to make sure, you know, there's no things that we've heard is no increase in safety risk or no net impact in carbon content or greenhouse gas emissions kind of situation. But there are different messages, and it depends on the criteria of how strong that message is.
Susan, do you think following this presentation, we could just get a little cheat sheet flow chart that shows how that might look and what level of further review might be built in, depending on where you calibrate it? Because I'm a more visual person, so if I see it on a chart, I think. And then I think it'd also be helpful just to get a couple of examples of what's the closest example on each side that we currently regulate, so we can test it.
It is possible to have it be a non-conforming use and write very clear standards that say you can continue this use in this place if you do these things. It's not, you know, in terms of how you had said that there, that we don't want you here, you know, that you are not allowed use in this zone. A non-conforming use can continue, and we could write up standards. So we'll put that on a table for you.
I think one of the things the council would want to know, too, is, you know, that balance between certainty and flexibility and not having the council become the place where all of these are decided, you know, on a regular basis. And that argues, I think, for some clarity about what you can and can't do at the front end. But then also what administratively, in your experience, fits a situation like this.
And we've had some good conversations with Paul Scarlett and his team about how would this really work. You know, they're the one behind the counter. They're dealing with this day to day. The other second issue, which is kind of behind all of this, is if we were to plan this now, would we have put them all in this zone, you know, where if an earthquake happens, this is the worst. And we've had this discussion a bunch of different times. And we actually started to look at, well, for Northwest Natural, for example, as a regulated utility, if they had to move and make them, because they're storage tanks, so it's a little bit different, would those costs be recoverable by ratepayers? And so we're looking into that, and what we've seen so far is it's a cost of doing business. And so, but that's not true, obviously, for the rest of them. And you should keep that probably in mind as your larger goal, which is, if your larger goal is to phase them out in that location, then I would tend more towards the non-conforming use versus the conditional use. And so that's, you know, more the broader picture, and then we'll put the table together to show you, you know, some of the options.
Just to close, we have a work session scheduled with the PSC on October 11th for them to come up with a recommendation for you, and we have this scheduled for a first reading and a public hearing on November 10th. So this will be coming quickly.
I have one other issue. There was in one of our hearings, there was some reference to possible legal issues that we have to take up in connection with this. And and depending on the how complex the legal considerations were, we would have a executive session or not. So I guess that the first question is, have you identified some high-level legal issues that we have to work through in connection with this? And if so, are we going to do a work session, or have you concluded there are no significant legal issues that require that?
We're working closely with the city attorney's office on to identify those risks. And I think the law, the federal law around these is complicated and not clear as to where local jurisdictions can be, especially in terms of reducing safety risk. And I think we have, based on the issues that were raised at the hearing last week, we have meetings with the city attorney's office this week to sort of narrow those issues and identify whether we need an executive session or some sort of individual briefing on specific issues. And so
And when we have the council hearing, we'll know exactly what the PSC's recommendation is. That's important. And then you'll have had more time with staff to staff. So I think that would be the window for them to call the judgment on the question of and the city attorney to say, well, it looks like there are some big legal issues. We ought to have that executive session or not and get back to us.
Although the way our executive sessions these days are reported, they seem to be almost like work sessions. I'd settle for an individual briefing if just to understand the lay of the land. And if there are unresolved legal issues or open questions, I'd like to know just sort of what the architecture is.
Good question. Other questions or follow-up needs from the Bureau? Obviously, again, we're going to hear from the Commission itself when they report out next month. But great. Thank you very much. Appreciate the chance to get us up to speed. Look forward. And we're done early.